There's no evidence that she was writing Harry Potter with the intent of dispensing witchcraft. There is a lot of evidence from J.K. herself and from the evidence of the text itself that she was, I'm not saying promoting Christianity, but working in the Christian story. It's all there. The sacrificial death, the resurrection, all that. And you may say, no, that's just a good story. But it also happens to be the Christ story, and she makes specific references to it. Whatever. You can read those details in the book.
Solomon, it's been a long while since I've seen you. A year and a half now, more or less. The end of 24.
Too long.
I think we met at Yale last time, and it was
yes, that's right.
It was a great speech by Harvey, right?
It was. Yeah. Well, that was all about free speech, which you care so much about. He got into trouble there. Do you remember that? Do you remember he used what we call the N-word in the U.S. and he said it audibly, and then the community around Yale condemned him.
Exactly.
Not everyone, but said, what a racist old man. And he was there with two or three black people who were his good friends.
Yes.
But you wouldn't have known that, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have known that from listening to his speech when Harvey made the speech at Yale and he was talking about free speech and he used the N-word. You wouldn't have known that there were black people in the audience who were there with him who were his friends.
Yeah.
So you would have passed judgment very quickly. It's an interesting statement on life. It's so easy to pass judgment. Yeah. You know what I mean? J.K. Rowling said something famously, which was, you can get a lot of pleasure from condemning someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can get a rush of adrenaline from judging someone.
Absolutely.
And that it's, and maybe that's why Christ said, judge not, because we're so bad at it. And that he was supposed to, well, first off, because in the Christian worldview, Christ is the ultimate judge. So when you take his seat, you're taking the place of God, and God alone is judge in the Christian worldview. But secondarily, we're just so bad at judging, right?
Yeah.
I'm a very cynical person, which I have to work on. So I don't know if you experience this, but I tend to assume the worst. Mm-hmm. And the problem is you can assume the worst because human nature often brings about the worst. So assuming the worst is a safe bet.
Yeah. Right?
Because if you're assuming that someone has a bad motive or that you have a bad motive, that's much more likely, or a selfish motive.
Yeah, the saying is, prepare for the worst, expect the best. So something like that. I'm butchering the saying.
Yes.
But it has a lot to do with what Harvey did back then in the speech. And the reason why, in my view, he used the N-word is that the context on which he said that, he was putting himself in the skin of the people who suffered discrimination. Because back when he was growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and when he was studying at Harvard, there was a lot of discrimination. And the N-word was not the only word that was used to discriminate people.
Right.
It was also an analogous one used for Jews.
Yes.
It was kike. That's not a controversial one that we should avoid by saying the K-word.
Sure.
But the reason why in the N-word it is controversial is that there's a moral panic around it.
Right.
And that's when there's panic and when there's this condemnation that you rightly pointed is made towards a lot of people and you derive a lot of adrenaline from doing it without really judging it properly. Because of his enormous advocacy of rationality, the scientific method, free speech, which are the same thing, really, he decided to make a case by stating it. And there's no pretension of his racism. This is a guy who is as open-minded and as respectful of other races, other cultures as there is.
Who adopted a child who was black. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if there's anyone who's in the right to mention this word while giving a speech, precisely making the point that it should be mentioned to make the case that mentioning it and reducing the adrenaline and the condemnation, the people, and only he could pull it off. Because if you notice, who has the social capital, the reputation, let's say, to be able to
get away with it.
To get away with it?
Sort of.
To be able to pull it off, doing it, and sending the signal. Because I think that was his purpose.
And that's why J.K. said she wanted to speak out in the transgender controversy, is she was secure enough financially. And even from a standpoint of where she was in life, she didn't care about, she cared about having death threats to her and her children, but she didn't care about her reputation from the standpoint of if 500,000 people unfollowed her on X, that wasn't a problem. So she recognized that she was secure enough and fortunate enough to be in a position where she could speak out on these things. And she did. And some people hate that. It's interesting. You talk about like how emotional and like fierce the condemnation was and how upset people were. I wonder if in some cases when you become really defensive, that shows insecurity, right? Like that probably doesn't take a PhD in psychology to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of, wise people are peaceful people, right? They're settled in their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what they think or don't think, or they know what they don't know.
Yep.
And they have peace with that. And they're humble enough to recognize how little they understand. And
yep.
So that gives you like a sense of quiet. I'm thinking about the wisest people I know. They're not loud, fist-shaking, shrill people. Mm-hmm. They're measured, self-controlled people. And I don't think that's just a subjective thing. When you think about people who are universally admired, even people like Pope John Paul II, even if you're not a Catholic, or Jane Goodall, the scientist, those are two completely different people, obviously. But even pick American presidents. Or other world leaders. A lot of times the people who are most admired, sometimes they're the really charismatic ones, right? But people who are universally admired by people of all different walks of life, whatever politics, religion, background, there's people who are universally admired by like 90% of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's oftentimes self-controlled, more quiet, more sure people. And I don't know, you get... I wonder where that sense of peace comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it for some people it's a spiritual thing? For some people it's contentment that they have found an answer to life that satisfies them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a number of factors.
Yeah, I think it's maturity. Being able to, the level at which they fight their rivals is not physical, but intellectual.
Mm.
So I said this quote in a conversation I published in my podcast with Harvey, that the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us.
So let ideas...
To let ideas die instead of us.
Ah.
So if you dialogue this, if you have what we're having now, a conversation between a person who is religiously leaning like you are, or religious, or Christian, you would call yourself,
yes,
and someone who is less religious than I am, also, although appreciating the virtues of religious,
the cultural Christianity,
yeah, kind of, yeah, but
it's hard to get away from that if you're Spanish.
Yeah, well, fortunately, the Spanish population have little grip over me right now, but
yes.
But yeah, you are absolutely right, and. The whole reason why the people who are the most admired are the ones that are the most, I don't know if soft-spoken would be the right way, the right word, but maybe rational speaking, they are not shouting. That's because we see a parallel neuroscientifically in the anatomy of the brain. The areas of the brain that are activated are mostly the prefrontal cortex, the frontal areas, the ones that evolve the latest, the ones that make us the rational animal. Those, if you're activating those, then you're going to pull off, or the chances are high that you will be able to contribute something new. But fighting and violence is nothing new. You're not going to invent anything by shouting or insulting another person. So trying in a calm way to make your case, like Harvey was doing back there in jail, it's precisely the right approach. And you disarm the enemy because especially because Harvey happens to be an older person.
Right.
He was speaking so soft-spokenly, so put to the point of the case he was trying to make about free speech. He would be the last person you would shout at.
Right.
And of course, the response that the people back then had towards him wasn't immediate. Immediately, no one complained.
Right.
It was after considering about it and trying to make a shitstorm about it that they criticized him. But in the moment, no one would think this is a so soft-spoken, well-spoken older guy who's making his case. But of course, the censorship-oriented people, let's say, were the ones who wanted to shut it down. And so the reason why these people like Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, the C.S. Lewis. Sorry, yeah.
No, that's okay.
He that's another very good speaker, without a doubt. And if you read what he wrote, he's a very calm, very rational person. Yes. And it's a common feature among people. And I think the reason is, going back to what I was saying, you don't bring anything new by shouting, but right. you do bring something new, maybe, if you speak properly and you have control over yourself, as you were mentioning.
Well, and it's the great debate that leads to different religions or no religions. When you just start thinking about, how do I view the people around me, right? Like, are you someone to be used to my ends, mm-hmm. purposes? And that obviously could stretch into a lot of different things. Not necessarily us, but like, mm-hmm. you know, in a wider sense, sexual exploitation, bullying, violence, right? Like, if your goal in life is to serve me and to give myself the most amount of pleasure, then that's going to have an impact on how you treat other people, yep. obviously. Yep. And if your goal is, and this is where I guess we'd get into the religious discussion, like the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do to you. Like that, in my estimation, fundamentally changes the way you live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because your purpose for life is different. Your life is to serve. And that's not to sound pious, because I'm not, when I say I'm a Christian, the other question is like, what the heck does that even mean? I'm not trying to sound like Jordan Peterson, but seriously. Like,
maybe we should. He has some good points.
He does. I defer to him. But we talked about this earlier. It's like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Does Christian mean you go to church once a Sunday or once every week on a Sunday? Does Christian mean you're a member of a denomination? And then if you say, no, Christian means I believe what Jesus said in the Gospels. Well, what? Because a lot of people think he didn't claim to be God. That's the Jehovah's Witnesses, right? He wasn't God. Then a lot of people say, no, the interpretation of these texts shows that he's God. The Gnostics said 2,000 years ago, there was no resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Christians also said 2,000 years ago, no, there was a resurrection. So it's like, what the heck does that even mean? And I guess you'd have to define it very specifically. And I guess if I could make an attempt at that, it would be, I believe Christ when he says that if you don't believe I am the Savior, you will die in your sins and be under God's judgment. I believe that. And I believe that he fulfilled the prophecies of the Old Testament to be the suffering servant to complete or continue God's plan of redemption for the world. So whatever you want to call that, if that's Christian or follower of Christ or whatever, I mean, I guess the term Christian came mm-hmm. from the city of Antioch in Turkey, I believe, in the first or second centuries, to mock followers of Jesus, to call them little Christs. That's where the term came from, as I understand. But yeah, so that belief also in Christ, that way of thinking about Christ also leads me to accept the Old Testament as God. Now that the God of the Old Testament is God. Now then, of course, that branches into a number of different questions. Like, okay, but there's 39 books in the Old Testament. And if you're a Catholic, there's more than that. So are these all the same God?
Hmm.
Are the people writing it God? Like where they're impersonating God and then thousands of years later, you're manipulating into believing that? What do you do about the violence in the Old Testament? Like there's so many questions there. But all that to say, my beliefs lead me to accept Deuteronomy 6 as the standard for how a human should live. Hmm. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So when you have that as a mindset, it's going to run against what you want sometimes. Like it's going to run against how I want to see people, view people, or myself. Like even though I am pursuing my career, from my Christian standpoint, career is not an end in and of itself. It's a tool through which you use to help people, mm-hmm. right? Or like, it even obviously has ramifications to how you conduct yourself or should conduct yourself personally. That's why Christians are so often accused of being prudish.
Right? But
you don't believe in these kinds of sexual relations or whatever. And it's like, no, it's not so much that. It's like, if you believe God has the, if you believe God intended the world to function in such a way, then of course that would have implications into the whatever realm, physical, material, financial, military, non-military.
Absolutely.
I go off. But I would write a creed.
I would slightly caveat your statement that maybe being a Christian makes you doubt what you want, or makes you, it is in competition with what you want. I don't think it's as much in competition with what you want, properly understood, but it is more in competition with what you want now, because it's aligning yourself with your future self. So if you, you're a being that expands across time and space, you're 1.80 meters long, so you... You have a physical dimension and a temporal dimension. And I think that the broader your spectrum becomes, and that has been what allowed Christianity has existed for 2,000 years. Well, whatever your time frame is, it's something that's very old, much older than we are. And if it has survived for so old, for so long, I would be skeptical of ditching it without a second look at it. So there has to be something of value in it for people to still pay attention to it. And if it was so damaging to society, it would have been weeded out just like a virulent virus disappears by making the host die off.
Natural selection.
Exactly. No, but this is, I believe that natural selection ends up determining what is right and what is ethical. This is another debate that I would need like 50 hours to explain fully. But what you were saying that Christianity makes you doubt or compete with what you want, I would caveat that with now, because it's a kind of rule of thumb. It's a something that your parents already lived with, that your grandparents, of course, it's amended in every generation and people interpret things somewhat differently. That's a natural progression and it has to happen and it's wonderful that it happens. So we adapt, just like science does. We adapt our beliefs so that we don't have to die, like the quote I shared before. That's wonderful. But to break a lance in favor of Christianity, and one of the reasons why I've become more appreciative of the tradition of the Judeo-Christian, let's say, of the Abrahamic tradition, is that it has survived for so much longer than I have. Yeah. And there's been so many millions of people observing this. Yeah. And it has been matched into the nature, into our human nature so well with myths, narratives, stories. It's a very important thing that you cannot just ditch without observing much. And I think that once you start expanding your frame, which is what Christianity allows to some extent, you start encompassing not only more of you, but so because you take into account your long-term objective. The Bible tells you not to be gluttonous. So the maybe my colleague Lucas, who offered us some... What was this thing he offered us? The
tiramisu?
Tiramisu, yeah. It's delicious, but we said no. Why? Because we were trying to not be gluttonous. And we thank him for offering it. But I think that if you're going to be virtuous, you have to stay to your principle. You have to stick to your principles. And that's what we did. And exactly now with that, if you take into account a longer time frame of your life, you start also taking into account other people's time frames. Because if you expand your lenses, you start encompassing yourself in the future, but also other people. And those two are indistinguishable, exactly what Jordan Peterson always says. Right. And this is why I admire him so much, because it is true. Once the selfishness that you were referring to in the first part of your intervention only happens when you're too narrow-minded. Mm-hmm. Once you become wise enough, exactly the people you were mentioning that were able to speak calmly and without shouting to other people, without disparaging them, that's the kind of mindset that allows you to align your incentives, your interest with other people. And that happens only in the longest of the time frames. So the more long-term I think about this interaction with you, the more our incentives are aligned. If I was thinking about it very short-term, maybe I could fool you into giving me $20 and have me have a good night of drinking today. But that would be the end of it. So it has no further relationship after that.
Right.
But if I'm thinking of long term, what this podcast could contribute to people by telling them about your story, about the incredible things you've done, by your very early age of 22, it's ridiculous what you've done.
How old are you?
24.
Okay.
So we're both pretty young, but what you have done is especially remarkable. And that's something that I wanted.
I appreciate that.
I wanted to get into that because this book hasn't come here randomly. It has been...
Are you talking... Are you saying there's an intelligent design to the universe?
No. I think natural selection could lead to the emergence of complexity without the need of a central planning top down authority. But the process that led you to do this book, how is it that you wanted to get in touch with J.K. Rowling and document her whole life and putting it into the most, if this is the most comprehensive biography of her that exists right now, right?
Yes. And that's why I wanted to do it, because it didn't exist. I'm wearing, and I apologized to you earlier for my informal clothing, but this shirt, my History Bites UK tour, I run a tour through England and Scotland themed around J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, C.S. Lewis of Chronicles of Narnia, and J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter. And I grew up loving these two authors. They changed my life. And just, they gave me such a deep perspective on existence. I'm not saying I'm deep, but they gave me such a profound view of life. They had such a profound view of life that really touched my heart. And that shaped a lot of my thinking of the world. And when I went to England and Scotland, or England, to the places where they lived, it was life-changing, because here were the places they actually walked and wrote and thought and swam and walked or whatever, or drank beer or coffee or tea. And so I wanted to give people that experience, who also loved those two authors. And then I had a friend who recommended that if I was doing a tour in England, I include Scotland, because of how scenic and historic it is. They said, if you're doing fantasy authors, add J.K. Rowling. And I wasn't into Harry Potter, but I thought, okay, all right, I'll read it and see. And Alex, the same experiences I had reading Lord of the Rings and Narnia, I had reading Harry Potter. For me, it was a deeply religious experience, actually. And that's not coincidental, because Tolkien, Lewis, and Rowling are all deeply religious people. Like this book, there's a, I was able to visit the church Rowling attended through her teens on her own. As a young girl from the age of 11 to 17, she attended church by herself, even though none of her family were Christians. And then she attended church into adulthood. And this picture, this painting of Jesus, is one that she kept in her apartment as she was writing Harry Potter. And what I saw in Harry Potter was some of the same elements in Lord of the Rings and Narnia, which is good wins ultimately. And that's kind of a funny thing, because all the evidence of the world would show us that good doesn't win, right? Because we all die, for starters. So as good as you can be, or as good as existence can be, it ends. And I think there's something in us that doesn't feel that that's right. Tolkien said that it was like a bone being out of joint. Like in the world, you know something is out of place by the fact that people die and that they're taken from us early or prematurely or what have you. And people die in horrible suffering, as you know. Infants die, children get bone cancer, all these horrible things. But yet, all these authors, they write books where good wins, and they're all highly rational people who lived in great suffering. Tolkien and Lewis lived through both world wars. They lived in the trenches in World War I. Tolkien's mother died when he was 12. Lewis's mother died when he was 8. Tolkien's father died when he was 4. Then Lewis's father died a little later after that. J.K. Rowling lost her mother at a vulnerable age. She lost, she miscarried. She lost a baby. She faced domestic abuse, lots of suffering. And yet all of them wrote books in which good wins. It's like, well, that's nuts, because the evidence of their life would seem to show that good doesn't win, but they write these books with good wins. So that was one thing. But then of course, like, again, not to get too religious here, but kind of the Messiah story is there. I mean, J.K. Rowling herself said that she chose the idea of a Messiah on purpose for Harry. And then he resurrects in King's Cross Station. You know, there's so many parallels that she herself acknowledged and put in deliberately, because that's what touched her heart, the story of Christ. And it touched Tolkien and touched Lewis. So I felt a great affinity to all three works of literature because of that. And then they're just good stories. I don't know if you've seen the movies or read the books, but they're just fun, exciting stories. So I was intrigued by her, I guess, is the bottom line. And there was no comprehensive biography. And I was appalled by that and thought that someone needed to do it. And thankfully, I'm in a position where I can. still live at home. My parents treat me very well. I'm going to be moving away for graduate school in the next couple of years, I think. But in that time, I've been able to write these books. And so I thought it was a good use of time. And I basically wrote the book I wanted to go into a bookshop and find. And also, I should add, the fact that Harry Potter was written by a single mother on welfare, battling abuse, depression, poverty, all these things. And it's the best-selling book series of all time. And that's who this person was. She was, like, if you had met her 30 years ago, when she was down and out and really having a hard time in life, she was not remarkable, seemingly not remarkable in any way. She's very plain, introverted, shy, looked down upon, depressed. But in her spare time, when she went back to her apartment at night, her little apartment, which she herself says, like, she described it as a dump with mice going through the walls, like, that lady walking through the streets of Scotland, going back to her apartment at night, she was writing what would become the best-selling book series ever and didn't know it. And no one knew it.
Apart from the Bible.
Yes. Another fictional book. That's a joke. Yeah. So that's kind of insane when you, because when I write the book, I really try and picture what it would have felt like, been like to see this, experience it. And then you want to give that to readers, right? So I've been to Edinburgh in Scotland a number of times. I've walked the streets she walked. So when I tell you and I describe in the book where she was and where she was going, my hope is you can see it because I can see it and I want to give you that experience. But it's just crazy to me to think about her having, her being the most talented at what she did, but no one recognizing that, because that means literally, with some exceptions, almost anyone you meet potentially could be the best at what the world at what they do, and you might not know it. Now you say, statistically, how likely is that? Probably low, but it's possible. And that's kind of, I don't know, it's life-changing to me because, again, you don't know who you're going to meet could be the best in the world at what they do.
Yeah.
It's possible. It's maybe low in probability.
Depends how much division of labor there is in the economy. Because if we all specialize in doing one thing on which we are very good, and in the extreme, this is all the advice of Joe Rogan, that you have to be yourself. Don't try to copy someone else.
Mm.
If this is something that Joe Rogan talked a lot with Chris Williamson, this other big podcaster.
Okay.
And Chris was saying, well, if I try to be Joe Rogan, it's going to be a miserable failure because there's already a Joe Rogan. So there's no way I'm going to compete with Joe Rogan at being Joe Rogan. He's going to win every time. But I can be myself. And that's exactly the approach that J.K. Rowling took. I'm not going to try to copy whatever other people are doing.
Right.
But the more you focus in what actually makes you different and the competitive advantage, of course, this is not going to be the case with everyone because maybe someone doesn't have some feature that makes him the best. But the more you are loyal to your tendencies, to your deeper, higher tendencies, the ones that makes you the maybe creative expression, the kind that J.K. Rowling, Albert Einstein, Newton, all these great people that got into their moment of calm and were able to write about their experiences and their reflections, that's a state at which you can excel. Of course, you have to be smart. So I don't know how this reflects on people who don't have the faculty, mental faculty. Maybe they can excel in other dimensions.
Sure.
But what you were saying makes me think that there's many more axioms or many more dimensions on which someone can be good at. So maybe I wouldn't be a good fantasy writer. My mind is not fiction oriented. Well, whatever sounds like a myth of our story, I instinctively doesn't grab my heart. But I am oriented towards science. So there's another thing. And maybe I'm good at synthesizing things. I grab different ways of thinking and I put them together and I find the convergence and the consilience. And that's what I like. So I figure out my own way. And I think that's the way you personally can excel. Figuring out what you like, what you're good at, loving the craft, working at it. And thanks to the fact that you're young, that you're still living with your parents, you have the time and you have the resources to be able to put your life into your hours into doing this work. And now it's something that you can be very proud about.
And I hope, without trying to sound like Mother Teresa, it does some good for other people. And that's the goal. And you made a lot of great points. And I think with JK, The funny thing is, she just enjoyed writing Harry Potter. It was fun. It was a hobby. She found it funny. Like, the jokes that she wrote were what she found funny. The humor was what she found funny. It was an escape from a miserable office job. And she just did it for fun, right? So it's interesting because she didn't have, as far as I can tell, some sort of grand purpose for, like, becoming ultra successful. Not that that's bad, but with her, she was just doing what she found fun. And it turned out she was really good at it to the point where people would pay her, right, to appreciate her work and produce more of it. And I don't have any other comment beyond just, I find it interesting that she didn't have a master plan for becoming successful. She stumbled into success by doing what she thought was fun. Yep. Now, I think we could both agree, you can't do that in every country, right? Like, you can do it in certain countries. That's what I guess they call the American dream. But of course, she's from Britain. So maybe the British dream. I'm sure they would get a stomach ache from hearing me say that. But that's something whoever can pursue their dream, you have to be deeply thankful, right? Work very hard. Jane Goodall told me something, which was that her mother gave her advice when she was younger, which was, Jane, if you really want something, you're going to have to work very hard, take advantage of every opportunity, and maybe you'll find a way. That was a great quote.
Wow. And non-coincidentally, these two women that you have been investigating and have been somewhat in touch with their body of knowledge, body of work that they've created throughout the decades, they are two that might not be able to do it now. If there's a J.K. Rowling now in 2026 doing their work, because of how controversial because of maybe the way it was written could be interpreted by some cancel, by the cancel culture, by the people who would like this book to be not published, or broadly the books she published back, the books from Harry Potter.
Yes.
And that's from one side. And I think they both point at the human nature. Jane Goodall also discovering the ethics of chimpanzees.
Yes.
She discovered that the morality in humans is not something exclusive of humans. Mm. It's something that is much broader. It's the coordination between beings in an ecology.
Right.
And the emergence of patterns of behavior and how to keep in check each other with tit for tat and different strategies. So this is such a broad topic, but they all converge into one single thing, well, into one single area, which is, I feel like it would be a pity if that couldn't be done now. And I think that in our current environment, someone like Jane Goodall or J.K. Rowling wouldn't be able to succeed as much as they did back then.
That's the fear people have about Christians, too, is that the censorship from what you might call the far right or the certain Christian groups who would burn Harry Potter books, which actually happened, certain Christian groups who would have not allowed Jane Goodall to research because she was doing it for the sake of studying evolution. I haven't studied evolution, so I would be a fool to start commenting on it. My religious background makes me initially question it. I'm highly skeptical of Darwinism, and we've talked about this because, and I'm going out on a limb here, there's danger, of course there's danger in religion, but I think there's great danger in seeing human beings as bodies and not souls. I know that's oversimplifying it, but that does get to the root of a very deep question, which is, are you the sum of your parts? Are you eyeballs connected to, you know,
nerves,
veins connected to heart? Is that you, or is that what you're made of? And I know that sounds super mystical and weird, but that is a fundamental question there. And that could probably be an hours long podcast in and of itself. I would say, when you're talking about that, I agree with you on a couple standpoints. The one is Harry Potter would be much too traditional now. Most of the characters are white. They're all straight. And as she said, Dumbledore is gay. Problem is, there's no evidence of that in the book, apart from a picture in which he is putting his arm across the shoulder of his friend Gellert Grindelwald, who was a teenage boy, blonde hair. Other than that, I mean, people who produced the movies with her assumed Dumbledore was heterosexual. That's how little evidence there was of the homosexuality. And then people who were gay, when J.K. told them that, initially there was excitement and celebration, but then later on they were upset because they said, hang on, if he was gay, why didn't you make that more clear? Are you ashamed of gay people? So there was that whole criticism there. So Harry Potter, I mean, heck, there's even jokes about people using different bathrooms. Why are you in the girls' bathroom? Like, you know, so Harry Potter is very traditional. Like, what? And in terms of the morality, my gosh, it's the most orthodox book you could possibly imagine. It's Christian morality and a Christian storyline. It is. I mean, that, and I've said that to Christians who are very skeptical of Harry Potter, and they don't like it when I say that, because we grew up learning that Harry Potter was witchcraft and satanic and was all about getting people to join the occult, which is factually incorrect. And that's not what JK's intent was. She is interested in the occult. There's evidence of that. Interest in astrology, interest in historical witchcraft. Yes, there is witchcraft in Harry Potter that was believed through different centuries to work. There's no evidence that she was writing Harry Potter with the intent of dispensing witchcraft. There is a lot of evidence from J.K. herself and from the evidence of the text itself that she was, I'm not saying promoting Christianity, but working in the Christian story. It's all there. The sacrificial death, the resurrection, all that. And you may say, no, that's just a good story. But it also happens to be the Christ story, and she makes specific references to it. Whatever. You can read those details in the book. But yeah, so all that to say, there's great danger that if certain people got to control the levers of power, that there would be censorship that wouldn't allow J.K. to publish Harry Potter or Jane Goodall to do research. And I don't know what I feel about that, because as a Christian, quite frankly, I think there are certain things that, let's say if you had kids, right? If I had kids and I was a Christian, there would be certain things that the teachings of Christ and the teachings found in the Old Testament, which Christ claimed were his word, would cause me to encourage or discourage certain things in my kids. I think I would discourage them from becoming a witch. I think, although, you know, maybe I could be talked into it, I think I would discourage them from believing in evolution, even though I know we can have a whole conversation about you, it's fact, it's there's evidence. I understand that's a whole separate conversation. But I guess all I'm saying is I have to be careful what I'm saying, because I don't want to sound hypocritical, which is like, don't censor Jane Goodall or JK, fellow Christians. Well, then, like, the tables could be turned. Well, would you censor certain things in your kids? Sure. But first off, JK wasn't promoting witchcraft. And even with Jane Goodall, the ultimate goal of her research was animals. She loved animals. She enjoyed spending time with animals. So it wasn't so much, here's how I can prove that Charles Darwin was God. It was, I love animals and I want to watch them and observe them and learn things. And people would have missed that. They would have assumed, maybe that's a danger. Maybe the danger is assuming, and we go back to this, what we were talking about a minute ago, assuming the worst possible motive. J.K. writes Harry Potter because she wants to promote witchcraft. Jane Goodall studies chimps to promote evolution. It's like, well, maybe those things are partly true. I don't think it is in the case of J.K., but it certainly is in the case of Jane. But maybe there's something that you're missing here that's also going to benefit you. That's the funny thing. I guess I'm talking to myself and to the Christian world too here, is Jane Goodall's studies benefit the Christian worldview. Here's why. If you can show that chimpanzees are much more intelligent than past ages used to think, that they have a moral structure, well, if you believe there's an intelligent designer to the universe, then of course his creatures would be intelligent. And of course they would have certain kinds of morality. Like, and you would find evidence of him or her, or whatever that designer would be, you would find traces of that designer, common features of that design in all their creatures. Mm-hmm. So, if, like, yeah, her research helps, in my view, helps Christianity. Probably have a discussion about that, among many other things. It helps that. And, of course, Jane Goodall believed in God. She believed in an intelligent designer. So, like, you're shooting yourself in the foot if you try and censor her. And with J.K., because the funny thing is, again, just to talk to the Christian world or just out loud, when she was writing Harry Potter throughout the 2000s, and there was a great deal of controversy from Christians who were concerned about the witchcraft and thinking it's satanic, she wouldn't talk at great length publicly about her religion. And she said, the reason is, I think I'll give away the storyline if I do it. I think if I talk about what my religious values are and what I believe personally, then I think she said this, the intelligent reader will be able to guess what's coming in the later books. The self-sacrifice of the Messiah figure, the resurrection, which is exactly what happens to Harry Potter. There was one or two or three, a handful of Christian commentators who looked at Harry Potter and said, whoa, 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 this isn't about witchcraft. There's really deeply moral things in these books. And maybe the reason billions of people like them is not because they want to become witches. Maybe it touches at something that is very deep and integral to the human spirit.
Yep.
Like, maybe that's why. And there was an author who said that, and JK commented. She said, now there's someone who actually has their eyes open. And what the author said was, Harry Potter is the Christian church's biggest missed opportunity. So I think this censorship also goes back to assuming the worst. And maybe that leads to a conclusion that stupid people assume the worst, which means that I have to then say I'm stupid because oftentimes I assume the worst. But we also go back to what I said earlier, which is a lot of times to assume the worst is the most logical assumption.
And we're
motivated by selfish or bad ends.
Yes, and we're all stupid to some extent, right? So I'm sure I also think of the worst at some cases. And it makes all the sense in the world. Mm. Many things can kill you, but not many things can improve your life dramatically. Mm. So it's very asymmetrical. Your life could become almost infinitely miserable, but how much better could it be than now? Mm. You're a fully functioning adult.
Right.
You're healthy. You're happy. You're pursuing your job, your project.
Yep.
How much better than that can you get?
Right.
Is there really much room away ahead? So of course the book sales could a million X maybe, but there's not that much upside, but there's a huge amount of downside.
Right.
And going back to the censorship of these two women that you mentioned, that someone asked you whether you should censor things of that your kid would access. And you said, well, maybe I shouldn't. But I think you actually should. Mm. Because the reason why censorship societally is not good is that people are adults. Paternalism towards adults doesn't make sense. They are fully functioning people who should be given the freedom to act as to the extent to which an adult can act. Mm. And the fact that people are becoming paternalistic towards this, the Harry Potter or the research that Jane Goodall conducted, is a paternalism towards a society that has no, maybe my liberal, classical liberal values are
right.
showing here.
Right.
But I'm very skeptical of whomever says that those things shouldn't be shown. And the witch trials that she went through, and that's the reason why she did this series of podcasts about the situation of the transgender, like the controversy that she went through, that someone wants to censor something would only be justified if the person cannot deal with it.
Mm.
But adults are, and also kids, but more so adults because they have all their features or all their features fully developed, are remarkably capable of dealing with differing opinions.
Mm.
And that you become paternalistic towards other adults, it's nonsensical. Mm. But with your own kid, I think there's plenty of things you should censor from your kids.
Sure.
You know, pornography, drugs, violence, there's plenty of things that I think are not fully functional for a young mind. And of course, there has to be some things that are removed from their environment while they're growing up. But once they're fully functioning humans, and of course there's a spectrum towards that, you have to give off. Give off the, you're not anymore in control as a parent, and you have to let them do their own thing. So the witch trials that happened with her, I think it's a more of a common pattern occurring in society that we've become especially sensitive to disagreements.
I wonder what your thinking is on this. When you're talking about a society in which you have fully grown adults and the government, in our way of thinking, or the American or the Western way of thinking, shouldn't be micromanaging them, treating them like children, whatever you want to say. But there is a point at which your behavior causes the authorities to step in at times, right? So I guess an interesting question would be, at what point do adults need to be held accountable? Or at what point does your behavior, at what point should someone have the authority to control your behavior or try to, or try and curtail your behavior? And I guess these are really broad-ranging philosophical questions on which nations are built. The Declaration of Independence says that government should be the guards of liberty, the guards, or secure our rights, that to secure these rights is the end of government. And when you look up what the meaning of the word secure was in that sense, it was make safe, shore up. So it doesn't mean I give them to you. It means I keep at bay those forces that would take it from you.
Yep, exactly.
And those are two different ways of thinking. And no, so I'm just interested at what you think by, at what point is it right for there to be an authority over fully grown adults mm-hmm. that steps in? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, the same thing that would justify it over adults is the same thing that justifies it over children. Mm. Children, because they're not mature, they don't conceive of the whole spectrum. They don't think, as you develop, as your prefrontal cortex develops, and many different areas of the brain also help into this, but you start accounting for more. Just like the expanding circle that we've been progressively believing that more and more people should be subjects of rights, women, some animals. We're expanding our circle of what is considered to be righteous, or I don't know if righteous, sorry, that's the wrong word, but worthy of respect, or worthy of considering eye to eye. I'm not superior to you, you're not superior to me, we're peers. I think that as you become wiser and more developed and more mature, you start considering more and more. Children don't do that as much. That's why we have control over them. When the parents have control over the kids and what they have, what they can do and what they can eat. And because the kids don't take into account as properly as they should the long-term consequences of their behavior, not over them, not over other people. So there's negative externalities. And this is the core of the reason why people believe that the state should intervene in the economy. Because there's a negative externality that you are creating by having your own business. You are creating some kind of inequality by having lack in your business and not having it be justified by anything virtuous that you did. Right. This is the left-leaning way of thinking.
Right. Bitter way of thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And because there's this supposed negative externality in the market, that what you do doesn't fully account for the consequences of what you're doing, you're only getting the good side and not paying for the bad side because of that negative externality, which is a mirror image of what happens with kids and why we have control over them. If a being is not able to account for the consequences, there has to be something else outside that polices it. So in the case of the kid, or in the case of the citizens in a social democracy, the control over the citizen happens because they are presumed to not be able to account for the future and other people as properly as possible, as it would be desirable. And interestingly, I'm now writing an article called From Trade to the State and Back, a bit mirroring a hint at the book from Daniel Dennett, From Bacteria to Bach, Bach and Back.
Yes.
And I try to go from the emergence of an economy, trade, the state, and then state failure. And the same market failures that people justify as they claim to exist to justify the intervention, the coercive intervention of a monopoly on violence. It's the definition of a state. The state is a monopoly on violence. And in my agreeable days, I happen to be a classical liberal. So I think that we do need some state to some extent, but to protect property, exactly as you were saying, but as it expands away of that, and it starts taking into account social issues like discrimination or inequality or social support, things that sound very good to the ear. But once you think about it, it leads to full dysfunction and the and destruction of value and everything that you can conceive of. It makes the society work less properly once the state becomes too big. So I have my own bias. I happen to be a classical liberal. But where I'm going with this is that once the state is realized, that also creates negative externalities. If you just like, if we go to a dinner where the bill is split, humans or even us would have a tendency to eat more than we would if we were paying for our share, right? Sure. So that's a negative externality that happens. And that's something that by the leftists is claimed to happen with the market, but it also happens with the state. The state creates huge negative externalities when you collectivize something, because I'm not the owner of it, but I'm enjoying it. So why not pollute it?
Right.
So the supposed good intervention of the state to solve pollution creates even more pollution in other ways.
So you have, and that's partly because you have no responsibility for it, or not responsibility. You have no emotional attachment to it, or and I'm looking for the word, like when you create a business and you've invested a lot of time and energy and money and yourself into it, you're attached to it, right? You feel responsible for it. You feel proud of it. You feel protective of it. You want it to succeed, right? Like it's yours. It's your own. And there's an incentive there. It's built in. You're incentivized to make it succeed, right? When it's not yours, you could destroy it and not feel bad about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
King Solomon was brought, in the Bible, was brought, he was described as the wisest man who ever lived, right? And there were two women. He would make judgments as king. Probably know this, would make judgments as king. Cases would be brought before him. They would ask for his counsel, his thoughts, his direction. And these two women, Israeli Jewish women, came up to him. And there was one baby living, a living baby. And these two women were arguing over whose it was, because they, in that time and culture, they would, you know, sleep with their babies. And then sometimes, sadly, a woman would like roll over onto the baby and suffocate it in her sleep and not realize she was killing her baby. So that happened. And the ladies were disagreeing over which baby was which. Did one of the ladies switch them in the middle of the night? You know, oh no, your baby didn't die, or my baby didn't die. You switched them. Like you saw that your baby was dead and then you switched them while I was asleep, or whatever. And King Solomon, there was no movie, no cameras, no recording, no way to know. And he said, bring me a sword. And he took the baby and he said, I'll kill this baby and I'll give you both half of it, him or her. And the one mother goes, no, King Solomon, please don't kill the baby. She can have him. She can have him. And he goes, that's her baby, because she cares. Right? She cares. And the other lady was saying, no, divide him up, kill him. Like, that's it. And I guess that's a picture of capitalism, or maybe not capitalism, but what I'm talking about, that system of being incentivized. And people have pointed that out about communism, right? I haven't studied communism in depth, but one of the things that stood out to me right away is that very fact, when it's not your creation, you don't have that same level of attachment and incentive to care for it, build it. And maybe that means we're selfish, but I don't know. I think we're made to create beautiful things and appreciate beauty and want to create things. Tolkien had a theory. He called it the theory of sub-creation, the Latin word for under creation. He believed that because we were made by a good creator who had designed the universe with an art and a beauty, that there was something built into us to want to create in his likeness, sub-creator, create under him. Like him. So whether that's books or music or movies or whatever. And it's not an overly like shocking thing to think about. So perhaps it doesn't, that idea of incentive to care for something we create doesn't mean we're selfish. It just means that's a good part of our nature. We're made to create something beautiful and care for it. Even a garden, for goodness sake. You tend and care for a garden and you want the plants to grow beautiful. And if it's not your garden, then maybe you care because you would see it as God's garden. Yep. And maybe that's where religion is an antidote to
parochialism.
Apathy.
Yep.
Right? Religion sees purpose and significance behind everything in the universe. So that is radical, obviously. It means you have a purpose, mm-hmm. whether the government says it or not. Whether I say it or not, whether your boss says it or not, not that your boss doesn't say it or not, but it's like you have a purpose. And that's what they talk about with the whole image of God, right? The Judeo-Christian ethos gives us this belief that we're all made imago Dei, the image of God. And it's like that is said so much that it becomes a cliche, but it's also true because, well, and we've had discussions about this. When you start to, I see a great danger and people much smarter than me see a great danger in viewing people as an economic unit. I'm not saying that's how you view people, but that is my fear with atheism and Darwinism. And maybe we'd have a disagreement about that. And maybe you'd say, I'm misunderstanding it. What I see the Christian ethos as protecting against is just that. Mm. Christ spent his time on earth with prostitutes, disabled people, poor people, people who are useless from the standpoint of contributing to a robust economy. Now, he spent also time with fishermen, and he himself was a stonemason. So he worked. He built houses. Jesus was a construction worker, right? So he contributed to the economy. He told Christians to work. It said in the New Testament that those who do not work shall not eat. So there's a basis for an economy there and a society there, but he spent his time and cared deeply about and showed love to people who were useless from the standpoint of, and I'm not trying to sound cruel, I'm trying to sound factual. They were useless from the standpoint of becoming billionaires or whatever the equivalent would be back then.
Yes, but why do we honor veterans?
Sorry?
Why do we honor veterans?
When honor?
Honor, yeah. They are useless, right? They are old people who cannot do anything. Mm. Why do we honor them? Mm. Think about that. Mm. It's not necessary for them. Mm. Of course, it's a signal to society. Mm. We're taking care of the people who are not as well off now, who tried, who provided to society, in order to, we're going to honor them now so that the next person thinking about coming into the military thinks about it a bit more optimistically.
I'm even though talking about people who, like I have a family member who's mentally disabled, probably know someone who's mentally disabled. They never have been able to and never will be able to contribute to growing an economy. They, people could view them as a burden on the economy, right? So that is what Christ counteracts against. Christ would tell you that that person is, you know, or me, and I'm not saying you, he would tell us, that person is made in God's image, has divine worth, period. No matter how much they can contribute, that the billionaire's life, even though that person may be smarter, more interesting, more funny, they don't have a greater right to life than that person. By the way, that's also the Declaration of Independence. My gosh, that's exactly what it says.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to sound overly simplistic, but... it is self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Like, what that's exactly what that means, that people have inherent worth and dignity. And that's why people make the case that America is built on Christian values. It doesn't mean that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and all these people weren't of the Enlightenment period. Of course they were. And of course the Enlightenment was an enormous impact on America. And of course people are right to say that. Like, no one's disputing that. Absolutely not. But when you go to the Jefferson Memorial, you literally just have to go to the Jefferson Memorial in D.C. What is the main quote they throw up there that Jefferson said? Now, he didn't believe in miracles. We know that. You know that. The New Testament he carried had all the pages of Jesus' miracles ripped out, but he kept all the teachings of Jesus and read them. Okay, Abraham Lincoln said that Jesus had more wisdom than all the philosophers combined. And the quote you see on the, and I guess I'm making a stump speech for Jesus. This isn't a come to Jesus moment. I'm just thinking out loud. Do you know that phrase, come to Jesus? We use that in America. It means like, I'm witnessing to you. Like, mm-hmm. I suppose I am, but not really to. We're just talking. But like, when you go to the Jefferson Memorial, mm-hmm. the quote they have from Jefferson is, if I can quote it, "God who gave us life gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed the conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." Like, there it is. An Enlightenment secular thinker, supposedly, but no, the thinking is rooted in this idea that there's inherent right and wrong, inherent dignity and value, and that God will, that's written into the universe, and that is how I should view other people. Anyway, I'm thinking out loud. Not that these thoughts are worth anything.
I think they are, and a lot. And I think that the best of each dovetail. Yes. The best of the secular, rationalistic, rational enlightenment types, which I like to consider myself part of.
Yes.
And the religious people, they are part of a, I don't want to hijack this term, but they are part of a co-evolution. So they both together, not in the biological sense. That's a different debate which we could have. But it is a fact that as in this conversation, we're both evolving, we're both learning from each other, and we're both changing. So I think that the same dynamics happening at the societal level between the secular rationalistic people and the religious, more dogma-oriented people, and they feed each other. I think the religious people remind the rationalists who want to change things fast that there are some old things that shouldn't be changed. That is the conservatism. And there's the other people on the other side, the progressives, not in the political sense, but in the epistemological sense. They want to change things. So let's debunk hypotheses. Let's get rid of the old dogmas. Let's further our scientific understanding of the universe. Let's build the next rocket. Let's conquer the galaxy and then the universe. And I like those people, but there's something missing there. Mm. As much as I like those people, there's something to having people remember what worked for the last couple centuries and say, you have many new ideas. Mm. Most of them are bullshit. You have to remember that. And some of them are very important that we should keep them.
Sure.
And let's pay attention to this, how it evolves, to make sure that we keep the good ones and ditch the bad ones. And that also happens with the old lessons. You wouldn't agree with the Christians from the 16th century. And that's good because we evolve. Everyone evolves. Maybe not everyone, but every generation evolves from the previous one. And there's a constant modification of what we believe in. And that's what it's needed. That's free speech. Mm-hmm. In its core, at the bottom of the free speech, there's the possibility to ditch what is wrong and grab the new thing that we think is better. It's never perfect, never the truth, but it becomes more functional, better functioning, more consistently converging with what we believed before. And I think there's a lot of value in what you were mentioning. Mm. The perspective of the Christians or the religious people doesn't have, I wouldn't ditch it fully. I think there's some wrongness to it, because it benefits from science. Mm. And a lot of the things are dogmatically opposed. Mm. But there's also some benefit to dogma. So it's a very difficult double-edged sword of civilizationally that we have to keep both sides sharp, the progressives and the conservatives, to be able to move forward. And so you have to remember what worked and look for new things. Mm. How do you do both things simultaneously? Maybe you cannot within a person. Ideally, we would. That's what the scientist would aspire to remember what works and keep doing. But it's easier to break things or to hold into things. If you, the division of labor there, you hold into things, you're conservative, then you become very good at it. Mm. Or you break things and then you don't have any dogmas and you try to move forward. That's also easy to take as a perspective. But having both in your own mind, that's something I'm struggling a lot with. Mm. And I haven't been able to fully do.
Sure. Well, and hey, it sounds like from your comments here, I'm not trying to flatter you, you're coming at these things from a humble, mature perspective, which is there's so much I need to learn. There's so much I'm still figuring out. There's wisdom from the past ages that is, most of my new ideas are going to be BS and all that. Like, I think you're coming at these things from really mature perspective. Not that I know, but I mean, yeah, we sit here and I'll speak for myself, I'm a speck on a speck of a planet in a solar system that's a speck of a galaxy, in a galaxy that's a speck of the universe. But, of course, the interesting thing is the only life we've been able to find is on this planet for now. Not that there isn't more.
Complex life.
Yes. So that would lead, again, to two divergent paths. Is that the Big Bang and evolution? Or is it intention? A mind?
Both are synonymous.
That's an interesting debate. And I love, by the way, I just go off on these religious branches because I love the debate, the conversation. This is, I'm not saying one of us isn't right or wrong. That's, I'm not the judge. God is, I believe God is judging. If he's up there or around here, then it's none of my business to try and make people believe things or not that I even could, but I think that's the danger is when you start trying to make people think the way you do. Jefferson said, God who gave us life gave us liberty. And so that's like, it's a really arrogant thing to think that I'm in a position to start telling you what you should believe. I don't think that. I think, you know, well, Christ took upon himself the right of telling us what to think, right? That's the interesting thing is he had no qualms about saying, here's what you should believe. Believe it, or you'll face certain repercussions. So those are his words. And I think the problem is when Christians take it upon themselves to be as though they're Christ. And that's where the pride comes in. That's where the destruction comes in. That's where the violence and wars and bigotry and all that comes in. And the great thing is, you know, when you can love someone as a friend, as a colleague, whatever, then you want to learn from them. You want to listen to them. You want to hear them. You want to grow from being around them. And I think you can do that with just about anyone, because people are smart. People have experienced things. People have made mistakes. People have lived through suffering, lots of suffering. And that's in the moments when I'm not so high on my own opinion, it's a really great perspective to have. You know, I want to keep that and have that in front of me always. Jordan Peterson says, always listen with the assumption that someone knows more than you. Seems to make sense.
This is exactly, I was listening today to a conversation. It was more of a conversation than a debate between Michael Shermer and Dennis Prager.
Mm.
Dennis Prager is a very religious person, and Michael Shermer is one of the most skeptical and scientific method kind of person you can think of. And I'm going to have a chat with him in the next couple of weeks.
Excellent. Yeah.
And I was surprised by the quality of the conversation. They were very different, but they also converge on many things. And that's exactly what I was aspiring to do with this conversation. And I think we've succeeded to some extent. And I'm very grateful.
I don't know if you've taught me. I've learned from you.
It goes both ways. I think there's lessons that everyone can learn from each other. I think there's something to it in every way. And what you happen to be now in a trip through Europe.
Yes.
We're now in Switzerland.
Yes.
But you're not going to stay here for long.
Sadly, no.
Where are you going?
No, I'm going to Ukraine for research for a biography I'm working on about Donald Trump. And I was in Israel and Gaza a few years ago. It was very helpful to see the situation on the ground for myself. It changes your perspective. And when you go to write about things, if you've seen it, you can write about it with emotion and insight that you wouldn't have if you weren't there. That was going to Scotland, where JK lived. You see things, you smell things, you notice things, you hear things, you taste things, you feel, you get the experience, which then you want to translate through words in writing, obviously. I have a friend who runs a foundation in Ukraine called the Ukraine Freedom Project, and there was a lot I didn't understand about the war, still don't. A lot of questions. And there was an opportunity to go in what statistically is a somewhat relatively safe way. Now, what I mean by that is, like, I've been told the statistic of an American civilian dying in Ukraine is very, very, very close to zero, which you want it to be zero. And by the way, I'm not trying to laugh or make light of it. It's a horrible situation, obviously. Hundreds of thousands of people gone. And in suffering. So going to learn to conduct interviews to see what's going on, obviously try and make it out without any problems. I suspect it'll be a deeply life-changing experience. I'm not sure. I've got friends there in Ukraine who I'm very sad for. They fight, you know. And it's been interesting from the standpoint of learning about the geopolitics behind it is interesting in sort of an intellectual way. It's disturbing and sad, you know. Learning more about people like Putin, Zelensky, Poroshenko, the different Russian oligarchs, U.S. policy decision makers. It's amazing how the decisions at the top can have such wide-reaching ramifications. You know, I've thought about this with Adolf Hitler. There were so many more ramifications to that war than the people who died, which is the biggest and most important part, obviously. But my grandmother is from Austria. She was born in 1945. She emigrated from Austria to America when she was 4 years old due to the negative effects of the war. And she had a twin who was 4 years old. He was too sick with tuberculosis to make the boat and come over. So he was separated from his family. It ended up being for life, which was terrible. But like that is a result of Adolf Hitler's decision-making. So you just can't even fathom the ripple effects like in the universe from these terribly evil decisions, not just on your generation, but on future generations. The Ten Commandments say that. Jehovah says, I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. It's not an exact parallel, but I think part of what that's saying is there are going to be, when you make evil decisions, that is going to have a negative impact on generations. So anyway, all that to say, yes, heading to Ukraine, and I'm hoping to have a productive and meaningful time there and figure out how I can write about the war in the most accurate way possible and what the results have been of U.S. decision makers, specifically President Trump, and try and serve the Ukrainian people in whatever way I can. That's not me taking sides in the geopolitical debate. It's just saying I have Ukrainian friends and want to be of some service to them if I can in an accurate, fair way. So yeah, that's why. Wish I had more time with you and in Switzerland, but it's better than nothing, right?
What a wonderful experience that are ahead of you, and I hope everything goes well.
Thank you, Alex.
You've certainly already lifted your fair share of civilization, and you will keep doing it.
Thank you.
Maybe in the way back, instead of taking a plane, you can come by
that would be fun
and show up in Switzerland again.
We could. There's so much to see here, isn't there? There's a lot to see in Europe and in Switzerland. Well, yeah, got to spend more quality time together. Not enough. That's one of the sad things, right? Is when you have friends, when you're a friend with someone far away, that's one of the sadnesses of life is the distance between friends. But thank God for the iPhone. As much as people run it down, we can instantly communicate. It's nuts. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate the time. Got a lot to learn from you.
Thank you, Solomon. Likewise.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, and then the bruise for people who are seeing on my arm, I fell down the Matterhorn. So that's not exactly the Matterhorn, but on a hillside near Zermatt, flipped over the bike. But hey, love Switzerland. Good memories.
Wonderful.